Happy Thursday, everybody. It's the Bill Buckmaster Show. I'm not Bill. I'm Tim Steller, columnist of the Arizona Daily Star. In the studio here with Tom Fairbanks on the controls. Tom, what are you thinking? Are we finally, is our long local nightmare finally over, i.e. the 100-degree heat and 20 days of record temperatures?
That has been a nightmare, hasn't it?
It really has. I mean, we expect these days, October days, to kind of give us that relief. And honestly,
but you want to know how a pessimistic thinker like me regards this?
Sure.
I'm wondering, is it going to be even worse next summer?
Yeah, of course. Those worries are with us. But for now, let's just enjoy where we are. I am in the studio here today with Tom Litwicki. Tom Litwicki, CEO of Old Pueblo Community Services. This is the Green Things Zocalo Village studio, of course, here on the campus of Bustos Media. Tom is been CEO for quite a while of Old Pueblo Community Services, which serves homeless people and people with other needs. And we will get into that. They are today having the grand opening of their new Center for Housing First. And so, Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
Yeah, no problem. Tell me about this. What is this Center for Housing First? What is it?
So the Center for Housing First is a project we've been working on for about 3.5 years now. And essentially, it's the Urban League's old campus on Park Avenue. Mm. And there's two buildings, about 20,000 square feet on the campus. And it's really designed to be sort of our hub or our foundation for spreading Housing First and services throughout the community. So at that location, we do our intakes and assessments, have all of our screening services and our outreach teams, case management for people that are in permanent housing, outpatient behavioral health services, employment services, community partnership. The partnership is really about getting more nonprofits engaged, mm-hmm. and working with evidence-based practices and expanding those throughout homeless services.
So it's not a shelter then?
It is not a shelter. So we have about 10 shelter locations throughout town, and we have two new shelters coming on, one for youth and one for adults who are unsheltered in the streets, another 150 beds, and that'll come on next year. This is kind of the glue that holds that all together, all the support personnel, all the services, all the outpatient services to get people into those shelters.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you and I were reminiscing before the show started about when we first met, which was at least a decade ago, probably more like 13, 14 years ago. The problems were different then, right? Like today, people are very aware of what we refer to as homeless people, that is people on the streets, in groups at bus stops or in washes, what have you. How have things changed as far as you've seen it in this area since you started, or since that time we met 13 or 14 years ago?
Sure. Yeah. So probably the biggest thing is just the sheer number of people who are homeless. We were talking earlier when we first met, we had a street count when I first got into this work, and there were about 350 people on the streets. At the same time, it was clear within our inventory of shelter and permanent housing vouchers that we had enough resources to actually serve all those people if we just improved our systems. And what's happened now is that we've got, you know, well over 3,000 people on the streets, and we kind of went from this sort of small groups here and there to these larger encampments. So it's really become kind of a permanent looking, you know, structures and things that people are building up in washes and all over. And so it has now really exceeded what shelter and permanent housing services and beds are available. And people have, just in kind of a general observation, I think out at doing outreach and such, people have become even worse off with mental illness, untreated fentanyl addiction, things like that. So the problem's gotten a lot worse.
So, yeah, you mentioned fentanyl addiction. Are there any other factors that you can bring up that would have increased this homelessness problem that we're seeing so much?
Sure. It seems to be the consensus that this growth in homelessness probably has a lot to do with affordable housing and a lot to do with systems that are available for people with mental illness. And we're starting to see now people who are older adults that can't afford their apartment, who are homeless for the first time, a lot of first-time families that are homeless. So certainly it's a combination of addictions, mental illness, but also the actual access to affordable housing. And that's changed dramatically in the 13 years since we first met.
Yeah, and so that's just a function of the price of housing going up, is that it?
Yeah, the multifamily housing, so especially in the last few years. So we went from having an average of, say, 15 to 17% vacancy within multifamily housing, because most folks are getting into as a tenant and a rental in multifamily housing, and we had this significant vacancy. So property owners would typically want to fill some of that vacancy, and accepting vouchers and things like that were not the easiest thing, but it was better than vacancy. And then when the pandemic hit and after the pandemic, we saw the vacancy rate get down to like 3%. Mm-hmm. Well, that's essentially full. There are no apartments. And so once you see that, you see rents go up, vacancy stays low. That's starting to improve some, and we're seeing more vacancy in multifamily housing, but it really is that availability. We have a similar thing with employment. If employers can fill jobs with traditional employees, they're not really knocking themselves out to try and find reentry or homeless or that sort of thing.
Sure, sure.
So if the units are full, why would they take someone with a voucher when they can get someone who has a job and first and last month's rent?
Got it. This is the Bill Buckmaster Show. It's Tim Steller subbing in for Bill while he's on vacation. I'm in studio with Tom Litwick. Excuse me, Tom. I keep messing up your name. Tom Litwicki, who is the CEO of Old Pueblo Community Services. You can reach us on the Rincon Ventures Real Estate. I'm sorry, the Buckmaster Live Line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. That number is 520-790-2040. Tom, of course, this place is called the Center for Housing First, and you have been vocal locally over the years about the idea of housing first and why you think that's the correct approach to getting people off the streets or otherwise serving people who are homeless. Can you explain why?
Sure. So the first and foremost, housing first is an evidence-based approach. So I come from a background of seeing social problems or any kind of problems as having some sort of a predictable evidence. And you can look at, this is going to, if we do this, we'll get these outcomes. There's randomized clinical trials that will demonstrate what works and what works best for most people, not everyone, but most people. And then in public health, that's what you're going to implement. And so I support housing first because that's what keeps rising to the top when you look at independent research and study on what results in the most housing and people staying in housing the longest. Housing first, hands down, continues to be the leader in that. Now, someday there will be another leader. Right? Mm-hmm. That's science. So I'm not a housing first
forever
fanatic, right? Someone's going to turn around, I'll be 80 years old maybe, and they'll say, we're doing something better now. Yeah. And that's perfect.
Yeah. So housing first just means you take people off the streets and stick them in an apartment and leave them alone, right?
Yeah, I get that almost every day. So housing first is exactly, it's a nice model in the sense that the title is exactly what it is. It's housing first. It's a service-rich model that was designed for people with high addictions and mental illness who were living on the streets. So it's very much intended for people with really high needs and severity of mental, medical conditions. And so after people, we're just saying it's not a condition to get into housing. What we try and do is prioritize people based on the severity, the likelihood, the vulnerability that they'll die in the streets. About 300 people die in the streets at least every year. And we want to help those people get prioritized into shelter. And if they're still in active addiction, that's fine. As long as they're not hurting someone, if they're not immediate harm to themselves or others, then we're here to serve them. A lot of times that's been called low barrier shelter. This last year, we really started calling it what we think it is, which is compassionate shelter. So if we go from a compassionate view, you don't have to change who you are. You don't have to prove that you deserve shelter and safety. That's something that you should have as long as you're not a harm to yourself or others. Mm-hmm. And then because there's a lack of resources, we have to prioritize. We'd rather not prioritize, but there's only so many beds to go around and so many apartment vouchers. So we have to prioritize who actually goes into shelter, and not everyone can get into shelter. But really, it's about the evidence. For us, about 50% of the people who come into our compassionate shelters and transitional housing move into permanent housing. And on average, about 85% of those stay in permanent housing at the two-year mark. So it's a very solid model.
Wait, I'm sorry. So you said 50% go in, of those who come in go to permanent housing, and then 85% of that 50% stays within for 2 years. Gotcha. Okay. You've talked previously about treatment first. A lot of people think that it's better if you see someone on the streets or someone who's out of housing as a result of their addiction, that it's the best thing to do is treat their addiction. And in fact, getting better or getting sober a condition for getting housing. And that has a certain logic to it, I think. I think that's something you don't agree with. Is that right?
Sure. Yes, I don't. It does have a certain logic to it. It makes sense. So the treatment first model makes a lot of sense when you first see it. It assumes that someone needs to first kind of have their life together and be stable before you put them into an apartment. And that kind of makes sense. But when you consider the fact that an apartment, a house, whatever that is a primary need, you actually have to solve those needs before you can move on to higher needs. So it's really hard for someone to start getting into counseling and services for trauma and addiction when they don't know where they're going to sleep tonight and when they are in danger and when their basic needs are not being met. So you've got to be able to meet those needs first. And then once you see that, it's obvious. It's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. First, you need shelter.
Mm-hmm. And then the idea is that then you will have the mental capacity, all those other spaces, I guess you would call them, the space to be able to view your own problem, to start dealing with it, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. So I'm a therapist. I come from a background of providing treatment services to people with addictions, and that's my entry into this sort of work. And so I was really surprised when I started working with folks who are homeless veterans who came into low barrier shelter, at how quickly their mental acuity improved just by being in housing for a few days.
Yeah.
So they sleep, they eat, they are able to clean themselves, and how that totally changes someone. And then you can start working on the other issues.
All right, well, let's go to the first break. This portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by the famous Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. You know, Bill, how Bill says that when he's on the air, he just kind of almost relishes the word as much as he relishes tasting it. Mona's is located on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. It's open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch. Treat yourself to their mouth-watering pastries, including the famous Danish Kringle. MonasDanishBakery.com or BuckmasterShow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
On average, the Regional Transportation Authority annually contributes over $100 million to regional transportation improvements to supplement limited federal and state funds. This critical funding source provides funding for nearly two-thirds of our region's needed transportation improvements through its 2006 voter-approved half-cent sales tax. To receive updates on a new 20-year plan in development, visit rtanext.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Is Tim Steller in for Bill Buckmaster on the Buckmaster Show? I'm a columnist with the Arizona Daily Star, and with me here in studio is Tom Litwicki, CEO of Old Pueblo Community Services. How long have you been CEO over there?
10 years.
10 years. Okay, so you've been there a long time. Had a good look at things. You know, this is a crazy thing. And by the way, we're broadcasting here from the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studio. Buckmaster Live Line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Phone number is 520-790-2040 if you want to call in. You know, there's a thing that used to exist, rooming houses. And I've heard talk about, we're talking about homelessness, addiction, all those things. And I've heard talk that kind of in the old days, people who were on the margins, who had addictions or just ran into hard times, they could go to rooming houses and, you know, pay a weekly fee or something. That doesn't exist anymore, right?
You know, it sort of does still exist, but it's not, it's within kind of the behavioral health system. So when you think of board and care, people have referred to it as. So mm-hmm. someone has a house and people could live in that house. They're usually folks with serious mental illness that have difficulty with performing daily, you know, functions and meeting their needs. And so there are these sort of board and care houses. When state hospitals closed, those really grew. And in Maricopa County, there were significant lawsuits and they weren't run really well. And so it's not, you know, usually considered to be a great option. However, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because we're looking at purchasing some two-bedroom apartment complexes, and for folks who really need housing and are unsheltered, and they're all two bedrooms. So we really need to figure out with this, and there's a model that HUD allows for vouchers where you could have shared housing. And I think that's certainly not something just for the homeless community, but just in general, there's a lot of people who would like to probably spend a lot less on housing if they had an option to do so. So shared housing, board and care, rooming houses, all that makes perfect sense. And it's going to be right for the right people.
Yeah.
It might not be the majority, but there are people who need that. And tiny houses are another one that's always been very popular. Mm-hmm. My message to that has always been, tiny houses should be an option in our community. It's not just something for homelessness. There are a lot of people that would like to reduce their footprint and reduce their costs.
Yeah, absolutely. What about sanctioned camps or encampments, something that other communities have experimented with? Is that something that's a good idea, or what do you think of that?
You know, it's interesting. There's things like group shelter, mass shelter, which 5 years ago I would have said, let's not do it. And today considering the numbers we have, I've kind of changed my mind on that, because we have to. We just don't have the capacity. I haven't gotten there, and I don't think the evidence is there yet for encampments or for these sanctioned encampments, for a couple reasons. One is, my usual response to that to folks is that if the first encampment is erected in Sam Hughes, then I'll talk about it.
Yeah.
But if it's something where we're just pushing people to the outskirts of town, then that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
The other thing is that they don't really have good control over climate control. So you've got people on psychiatric medications who are now are living in tents out in the sun. And then the other thing to be blunt is that people are often very nervous about that, and I would be as a CEO, because now you have like required people stay somewhere. And if that doesn't work for them, or they are injured or something happens, you're liable for that. Mm. You're responsible for requiring them to be there. And yeah. So a city or a county certainly doesn't want that liability. The other thing is, I just think it's wrong. If we had a tornado, we wouldn't create an encampment with fences around it. If homelessness is really a crisis, we have air conditioned spaces. There are FEMA trailers. There are ways we could address this that aren't just a big encampment. It mm-hmm. says more about what we think about it than it being an actual viable solution.
Mm-hmm. Okay. By the way, this issue about, there's almost a chicken and egg question here related to substance abuse. Because substance abuse has become such a huge issue lately, and homelessness. So I've found myself reorienting my view and not viewing people who I talk to or see on the streets. Street people, as they're sometimes referred to. In the past, I might have, and still a lot of people do refer to them as homeless. Mm-hmm. And they may be. They may or may not have homes. But I have started to think of them, in many cases, as drug addicted first, or substance abusing, people with substance use disorder, to use the correct phrase. Does it matter, I guess, to you whether we diagnose them as having substance use disorder that caused their homelessness, or whether it's some other complex of problems that led to them being unhoused?
Well, I think that chicken and egg question probably matters when someone starts to move into recovery and they want to understand their own addiction and how to prevent future relapse in addiction, then those questions become important. As far as our intervention around shelter, housing, and services, it doesn't really make much of a difference because it's an immediate emergency sort of response. I try to keep remembering or looking at homelessness as an emergency response. It's a crisis. Mm-hmm. It's not... and. So that we stay with our urgency, mm-hmm. so that agencies and government sees this as an urgent concern.
Okay, we got a call. Paul has a comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I hope you don't mind taking a comment from somebody up in their 90s.
No, it sounds great.
My two brothers, back just before the Second World War, both belonged to the CCC boys, a federal program, and they worked in the mountains and national parks and so forth, building fences and roads and so forth. Matter of fact, one of them worked on the Mount Lemmon Highway, and they were paying those boys a small stipend plus three meals a day and a tent to live in. And I would think many, many of these people today could do exactly the same thing. And talking about the boarding house, I was in Class D minor league baseball in the late 40s, and we all, as Class D, lived in a big rooming house. If I recall, I generally had about six roommates, and we traveled around. Traveled around the mountains in a 1936 school bus going to these little towns. And I would think something like that could be brought back.
Thanks for the memories, Paul. That's great. Great story. But what about this idea that, that people ought to be able to be put to work, or, you know, something like that? Would that function with today's problems?
It does function, actually, I think. It has limitations because there are people that have severe disabilities, things like that, that really chronic illness. So it's not like everyone is, you know, able-bodied to be able to do that kind of work. We started the homeless work program under the inspiration from Councilmember Fibres at Ward 5. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things years ago was people said, well, do you think people will work? People will line up the day before to try and get work in cleaning up the streets, picking up trash, mm-hmm. Because the work relationship as a part of our identity is so important. So I think that's a critical part. It's a part that with the new center, we'll have an entire section for workforce development, because people need immediate opportunities for employment. Mm-hmm. And we're doing, like a lot of our other programs, is low barrier employment. So we're not asking for ID. We're not asking for all these barriers that often come in if a person doesn't have an ID. If who you say you are will pay you in cash at the end of the day, what you do with your money is a private matter. Most people will use it for things that significantly benefit them and their families. They work hard. So it's the work piece, I think, is critical. And I think we've spent so much effort in trying to just get people shelter that we're just now, after 10 years of this, really getting to the workforce development side and saying, okay, let's move beyond this and into that workforce development. Mm-hmm. There's apprenticeships that we have a Pima County one-stop employment specialist over at the Center for Housing First. And so there's apprenticeships that we could be doing with the Center for Housing First. There's lots of various employment services. We've started a training academy for the community. So you can take you can go to helptucson.org and just, you know, learn everything about Housing First that you want to and get a nice certificate in the process. Mm-hmm. We're close to getting our peer services training academy so that people who are homeless could be peers. So lots of options.
Yeah, and there's also obviously needs for these people. I mean, yes. I assume that you're tailoring these to the needs of the economy. In other words, you wouldn't train somebody to do something that there's no demand for. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Like the other day, on the street, I met someone who had almost got her nursing assistant's job. Certification, and got addicted to the blues, as they call them, the fentanyl. And we need more people like that to get past their addiction and into that job.
And they can. And we need to keep working with them. Oftentimes in homeless services and that, the idea of relapse has been a surprise.
Yep.
And it shouldn't be a surprise.
Thank you, Tom Litwicki, CEO of Old Pueblo Community Services.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The extraordinary beauty and craftsmanship of Mexican artisans is yours at Clay and Cloth in Barrio Viejo, featuring gorgeous clay pottery sourced from southern Mexico, including Oaxaca, Puebla, Merida, and Hidalgo. Also discover amazing textiles you won't find anywhere else in Tucson. Clay and Cloth also has an incredible selection of new Dia de los Muertos merchandise. See the selection on Instagram at Mad Max the Dog Shop and visit Clay and Cloth. Open Tuesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 310 South Convent, just south of Cushing.
Good afternoon. It's Tim Steller in for Bill Buckmaster on the Buckmaster Show. I'm really excited for this segment here in the Green Thing Zocalo Village studio. That's coincidental because we have here Master Gardener Deborah North. We're going to talk about gardening in this period of change. I say period of change meaning the season, but there's also probably a longer term change happening. I think we talked about that last time, didn't we? The climatic change, Deborah. So you can call in with your questions. The Buckmaster Live Line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. The phone number is 520-790-2040. We are just got through the hardest period I can remember in the autumn of heat. What did that mean as far as garden, like, did that kill off everybody's plants, or did that delay planting? And what happened with that heat wave we just had?
Well, I think you can look at it a number of different ways. It has certainly delayed any kind of fall planting, any kind of, you know, seeding of plants where the germination temperature, the soil temperature, the air temperature needs to be a little bit lower. So it was a little too early to put in lettuce seeds and kale and that sort of thing for winter vegetables. It's delayed us in being able to actually get out there and put in trees and shrubs. Mm-hmm. It has certainly stressed out plants. I'm noticing my citrus, and as I drive around, I see a lot of plants that are very, very stressed. Are they going to come back? I don't know. But I think this is a really good time to look at plants that are not as stressed, make a note of what they are, and think about putting those in your landscape, right? This is a kind of a test period for us to say, yeah, that worked and this one didn't.
So not only looking at your own yard or your own neighborhood, but just everywhere you go, take note of what's done well. Have you seen anything that's done well?
Well, what surprised me, and this is in like the harsh places, medians in traffic and so on, acacias seem to have weathered pretty well, not so many lost in the high winds. The red yucca, the Hesperalo parviflora is what the Latin name is, but they're called red yucca. They're not really a true yucca. Those are looking very nice. Mm. And of course, the Texas Rangers, which are ubiquitous.
They're doing very well.
Yeah, they're doing quite well. There's a beautiful cactus called Dasylirion wheeleri. I don't think it has a common name. You know, it's very long branching stems, and they're beautiful right now. So look around at what's working. Figure out what they are. Use your plant app or contact our plant clinic for ID and plant more of those and less of what has died. That's kind of where I'm at with it.
So I had a funny experience the other day. We finally, this last weekend, went out and bought a few flowers to put in potted plants around the yard, and which we'd like to do during the cooler months. And literally that night was the first time in a long time that I know of that the javelina visited our our Midtown neighborhood. And interestingly, in one pot, I had what is commonly known as a gazania, which has done well for me over this summer. Even one survived the whole summer and it continued to flower. And then the other was a pincushion, scabiosa. And they took out both plants. The gazania, there was nothing left of it. Yeah, and in fact, they've done that before with the gazania. The pincushion had a couple bites out of it, and then it was just basically the roots, and everything else was fine.
Yeah, they're just delinquents. Yeah. They're just scorched earth to javelina.
Yeah.
And you know, the interesting thing about javelina is they don't see very well, so they rely on a very, very intense sense of smell. Mm. And it's as if they can smell moisture. Right.
Yeah.
So they're very thirsty right now. We've been in a long, dry stretch. It's been too hot. If you put anything out, they're going to come for it.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a we have finally apparently made the transition into a cooler weather. Is that right? I mean, can we trust this, basically, do you think?
I wish I knew. All I have is a 10-day forecast. The 10 days coming up look pretty darn good.
Yeah. Well, so I guess what I mean by that, though, is like people like to plant greens or other food products, vegetable plants for this time of year. Is this finally a time when we ought to be doing that?
Yes. Yeah. So the tipping point for moving from warm season gardening to cool season for us is 55 degree nights, right? So you're looking for consistent 55 degree nights. They're coming. You can see them in the 10-day forecast. Advance the time you start really thinking about planting what you would normally plant in fall. Mm-hmm. And I love planting in fall because, you know, the vegetable selection for us, what we can grow now, is the best all year round. Mm. But it's also a great time for putting in new trees, new shrubs. And like you said, like, this is the time to put in flowering plants in your containers. You're going to need to water them less, meaning less fertilizer, less attention, and you'll get more joy out of them. Yeah. Quite honestly, than fighting them through, you know, when it's been really pretty dark from mid-May to
now,
October.
Yeah.
It's been long.
Tell me about that vegetable selection. You said that we have a very ample vegetable selection to choose from for planting now. Give me some examples or some categories, if you would, that will do well for a while.
Well, it's a great time to start thinking the cruciferous world, right? So broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, if you want to go that far. Mm. I don't particularly like to grow cabbage. It takes a long time to get one head, which I can buy for a buck at the grocery store. But think about sort of not exotics necessarily, but sort of off the normal grocery store shelf, right? So bok choy, pak choy, pak choy is a smaller kind variety of the bok choy, grows rapidly, very tasty, kind of a miniature, if you will. Now's the time for root vegetables. So beets, carrots, parsnips, turnips, which are all underused vegetables, in my opinion.
Yeah.
This is a great time for greens. This is when you want to put out all your leaf lettuce seeds. You don't even have to put those in a row.
Just scatter
them and then come. And then you harvest. You do what they call a come and cut along, or cut and come along harvest, where you just take very sharp scissors and come in and take what you want for that meal and let them continue growing. The plants continue growing. So one of the interesting things for us, because our vegetable gardening is a little backward from the rest of the country.
Yeah.
But what we grow in the winter has a much higher nutritional value than what we grow in the summer.
Mm.
Typically in summer, you're going to grow where you're eating the fruit of the plant. That says that fruit is sort of a distilled nutrition. It's still great, but the nutrition value has kind of distilled out because the plant is using a lot of the sugars and the energy so on. But when we're growing in winter, in fall, winter, and early spring, we are eating very close to the ground, right? Really close to the soil. And those food products have more nutritional value. So this, I think it's worth trying in the winter. Another one to remember is Swiss chard. If you plant Swiss chard now, you're going to be harvesting the same plant until maybe June, if you're lucky.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So speaking of that same plant thing, I read somewhere, this is about cilantro, which I like. I find the plants die off pretty quick or bolt pretty quick, and then you don't have much utility. So is it right that you can just kind of use them for, a couple of weeks, take the leaves and then plant another seed meantime? This is something I read somewhere. And then start growing another plant because you know that one's going to go away. Is that a good idea?
So that's a great idea. It's called succession planting. So it says you don't put all of your seeds out at one time. You do them in a succession.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with cilantro, it does bolt at a fairly low, high temperature. There are slow bolting cilantros, and we've moved from recommending regular cilantro, if you will, to slow bolt. So always look for the seeds that say slow bolt. That means that they will be okay until a higher temperature occurs.
Huh. Okay. So just if you would repeat that for me, because it's a little confusing to me. You said it's they're vulnerable to relatively low high temperatures.
Yeah.
So what would that mean? Like, in other words, they start to bolt at like 80 something degrees or something.
Yeah. Every plant has its particular temperature at which it's, you know, what happens when a plant bolts is it's trying to succeed. It wants to live
right.
to another day. And it knows it's going to die. So what it wants to do is rapidly produce seeds so that the species lives, right? Yeah. And every plant has a temperature, low or high, that occurs at. Cilantro tends, even though it's used in, you know, like salsas and things you associate with warmer climates, it's a cold season herb, and mm-hmm. it bolts maybe 85 degrees or
okay,
so.
Okay.
But there are slow bolting varieties that give you a few more temperatures or degrees of temperature before they bolt. Okay. And once they bolt, they get bitter, so they're unusable.
Ugh.
But you can collect their seeds and
yeah,
grow them
and
next
then grow
time.
Them yourself.
There
right,
you go.
Of course. You mentioned to me that there's a plant sale or something coming up. Can you explain that?
Yeah. You know, we're a self-funded organization. We're affiliated with the Pima County Cooperative Extension and the U of A, but we are fully self-funded. We have three major fundraisers a year, two plant sales spring and fall, mm-hmm. and a home tour in the spring. This Saturday is our fall plant sale. They have hundreds of plants, cacti, succulents, vines, mm-hmm. fruit trees, herbs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's from 8 to 11 at the Cooperative Extension, which is on Campbell, just north of Roger.
Okay, yeah. So it's on the, that's the building that's on the east side of the road, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So you take a right if you're going north, or you take a left if you're going south on Campbell
right.
to get into that building. We're going to go into our first break, or third break of the show here. This has been brought to you by Green Things, Zocalo Village, since 1970. Green Things has been the go-to place for your gardening needs. Green Things is on a lovely 13-acre site that is also home to Zocalo Village and all of those fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things on River Road, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, and on the web at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. In 2006, Pima County voters approved the Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year Regional Transportation Plan and half-cent sales tax. They are both effective through June 30, 2026. For the region to receive continued funding for another 20 years, the RTA is developing a new plan and tax extension for voter consideration. Public input will be key. To receive updates on a new 20-year plan in development, visit rtanext.com. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The News and Sun's media reach 75% of the region through newspapers, websites, social media, video, newsletters, and more. They also produce more than a dozen print and digital magazines annually for an audience of 70,000. Find them at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, covering your hometown.
We're back on the Buckmaster Show. This is Tim Steller of the Arizona Daily Star in for Bill. Our friends over in Silver City and Grant County are ready to welcome you back with open arms. Just 3 hours east of Tucson, there is so much to do in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, where there is plenty of social distancing, and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of the many things to do and great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. I'll say that again. Visit southwestnewmexico.org. We're back in the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studio with Deborah North, a master gardener with Pima County Cooperative Extension. Let's repeat that info about the sale this weekend. You got a sale benefiting the organization. What is it again?
Oh, right. It's our annual fall plant sale. It's from 8 to 11 on Saturday, the 19th. 4210 North Campbell is the street address. So it's east side of Campbell, north of Roger. We'll have succulents, cacti, fruit trees. We are a not-for-profit and we're self-funded. So we'll also have compost, soil probes, a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah,
and then you can stop by, ask the Master Gardener, and ask me your questions.
Wonderful.
Try to stump the stoop.
And if you want to try to get in now, you still can. The Buckmaster Live Line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. The phone number is 520-790-2040. So we were talking during the break about the adjusting to the new climatic world we're in. I mean, this run of heat that where we had, I think, 18 record hot days out of 19 days from late September into early October. I believe that was completely unprecedented, at least in recent climatic times. What are you doing and what should we be thinking about adjusting to that, I don't know, drier, hotter future, I guess?
We don't know exactly where this is all going to, but I think there are some things that we can be prepared for moving forward. I think we need to think a little more strategically about how we deal with our gardens. Mm-hmm. Maybe not be seduced quite so much by plants, but really be investing our time and effort into really good, solid drip irrigation systems that are that help conserve water and water plants when they're needed, not when we think they're needing to be watered. Another thing is really considering investing in both time and energy and money in water harvesting. Passive rainwater harvesting is not easy because it's a lot of physical labor to do it, but it's inexpensive.
Can you just define what that means when you say passive rainwater harvesting?
Yeah, so passive rainwater harvesting is basically observing your property, watching how the water flows, where it comes off the roof and that sort of thing, and digging out what are known as swales or basins, building up berms or higher areas for pathways or kind of almost creating dams and channeling the water to where the plants are going to be able to use it, right? There are the S's that you're looking for in that, and that is you want to slow the flow of water. You want to allow it to be able to sink into the soil and be used by plants. So that really requires getting out there and digging some swales and moving the dirt around, you know, lining with rocks. You can plant those areas up really beautifully using native wildflowers, using native plants along the sides of those berms, trees above, and take advantage of the water that we are given. It's going to be more erratic. They know that for sure. Rain may come all at once. It may not come at all. So nice to be able to collect that. Then there's active rainwater harvesting, which is where you have cisterns or barrels that are collecting off of the roof of the house. So, you know, even with the minimal amount of rain that we get, you can collect thousands of gallons of water.
Yeah, it was in our paper Sunday. There was a story that my colleague Tony Davis had about a UA-led study that charted the last 485 million years of average temperatures on Earth. And what I found really interesting, it's, first of all, we're in a very cool period in Earth's history, but the temperature is changing and increasing at an almost unheard of rate. Mm-hmm. And what that means, I understand, is that animals, plants, organisms of all types can't adapt fast right. enough. Is that and so therefore yeah. they risk extinction if they're out in the wild, I guess, or endangerment, right?
Exactly. So if you're a living organism that lives in the bell curve, you know, the edges of that bell curve, mm. right, where you need very specific temperature ranges to survive, or moisture, or other plant material to. When those disappear, you disappear. So, yeah. And, you know, honestly, I think humans are in that range, right? We're not the most adaptable of species. Mm-hmm.
But we're mobile, right? So
you were to an extent. There are a lot of us.
So speaking of mobility, one thing that I like this time of year is it's the time of year to plant trees if you're going to do that. Tom Litwicki, the previous guest, was passing through and you were passing in to the studio. He was asking about planting trees and what got blown down in the storms this year. So is there anything that any lessons we should take from this summer? That there were a couple really severe storms mm-hmm. that blew down trees. Anything we can think about if we're trying to replace trees that blew down or what have you?
The most important thing is if you're replacing trees, you need to plant them correctly. When you drove around after those big storms, typically you saw that the roots of those trees had not extended out to the drip line of what was growing above soil. And that says that they were not tended to or planted properly from the beginning. Mm. So when we plant trees, never amend the soil. It doesn't matter if it's a native tree, near native, or some highly adapted, maybe even a fruit tree. Mm-hmm. You dig out the native soil, you fill the hole back in with native soil. Don't amend it. And then you need to start watering immediately at the drip line of the tree to at least 3 feet in depth and infrequently. When we work in the plant clinic and we see tree problems, the first question is, how do you water? The biggest problem we see, and this is overwhelming, is the Pareto. It's the 80-20 thing. People will say, I water that tree every day for 15 minutes.
Right.
To get to 3 feet in our soil, it can take hours.
Right.
But just as an example for people, and this kind of blows people's mind. If you are watering a full standard size citrus tree in May or June, hot temperatures every year, hot and dry and windy, the recommendation is that you water them only once every 7 to 10 days, but they have to be watered to 3 feet in depth to be able to have roots that will support the upper part of the tree. So plant them right, water them right, and you'll have a better life. And then avoid certain varieties, most likely.
Give us a couple examples, if you would, in the closing seconds here.
Well, I have a lot of friends who are certified arborists, and the tree that they saw take the biggest hit this summer was the Desert Museum Palo Verde.
Palo Verde, yep.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to Evan North, Master Gardener, Pima County Cooperative Extension. And this has been the Bill Back Buck. Woof. Bill's name is Buckmaster. This has been the Bill Buckmaster Show. Tim Steller here subbing in for Bill.